DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW. Deep and dirty in the worlds of science and technology, I'm Zulfikar Abani. And coming up, as the painfully slow rollout of 4G or LTE technology continues its trek across Europe, we head to Guildford in the UK, where researchers are already working on the next generation 5G.
5G, it is not anything new to us. For the last 3-4 years, we have been focusing our resources and our time on a next generation of cellular communication system.
We're also heading to a 3D printing workshop in Dusseldorf to find out how you can print the components to build your own 3D printer. And we pop a few bottles of wine in Spain, where scientists are trying to prove that cork still does it better. All that and more right here on Spectrum. Do you remember when having a 3G mobile was cutting edge? Have you already got a 4G system powering the internet on your smartphone? Or are you fed up of being told to upgrade to the next generation of mobile technology? Well, if that's the case, then you might want to skip to the next track, because 5G is on its way. A multi-million euro centre is being set up at the University of Surrey, outside London in the UK, to make 5G telecoms a reality. Our reporter Robin Powell has been there to find out more.
Set in attractive green surroundings in the hills above the city of Guildford, the University of Surrey has been acquiring an international reputation for mobile telecoms research. A team at the Centre for Communication Systems Research here helped set global standards for 3G and 4G mobile technology. But the director of the centre, Professor Rahim Tafazoli, is now looking further ahead.
4G is being rolled out, and as far as the academia research is concerned, the research is done, finished. On 5G, it is not anything new to us. For the last 3-4 years, we have been focusing our resources and our time on a next generation of cellular communication system, fifth generation system.
The university has just received 2 large grants, over 14 million euros from the British government and 30 million from companies including Huawei, Samsung and Telefonica Europe, to set up a so-called 5G Innovation Centre. Tafazoli describes what the infrastructure of a 5G network could look like.
It will consist of a huge number of small cells, very small cells, could be as small as 50 meter radius. And so you can imagine for a countrywide coverage, it could run into hundreds of thousands of small cells. And these small cells are overlapped with much larger cells, we call it macro cells of order of kilometer or so radius, in order to fill in the gaps which is left behind by the small cells.
According to Tafazoli's vision, as I walk down the high street here, my 5G mobile device will be constantly choosing between overlapping cells in order to get the best data connection. The size of today's wireless routers, these cells could be placed on buildings or lampposts and bring each user data speeds of up to 200 megabits per second. Far faster than today's maximum speeds. Professor Jens Zander, the Director of Wireless Research at Stockholm's Royal Institute of Technology, says meeting the expectations of tomorrow's mobile user is the driving force behind 5G.
If you look at the data traffic growth, and as at least projected by companies like Cisco, they show basically exponential growth or doubling of the mobile traffic every year. If that is true, then by 2020, or well, let's say within 10 years from now, we would have a 1,000-fold increase of traffic.
Superfast internet, video calling, instant access to the cloud. Most experts believe delivering these services will not only require a change in the architecture of cellular networks, it will also mean using parts of the radio spectrum that haven't been used before. One team in New York is testing bandwidths far beyond those that are currently in use. Professor Theodore Rappaport heads the Wireless Internet Center for Advanced Technology at NYU Poly, where the research is taking place.
All of cellular today runs in the frequency range of about 1 gigahertz to 2 gigahertz. But there's all this enormous untapped spectrum up at 28 gigahertz, 38 gigahertz, 220 gigahertz. We can go much, much higher in the frequency band. And by doing so, we get tremendous amounts of bandwidth, 10 to 100 times all of the cellular bandwidth available today. That's the excitement, I believe, for 5G.
Meanwhile, network providers here in the UK have only just started offering 4G behind much of Europe, North America, China and others. That's brought the government and telecoms industry in for ongoing criticism. But Keith Robson, the Director of Research and Enterprise Support at Surrey University, thinks the new innovation centre will propel the UK ahead of the global competition.
We would expect to see a raft of companies starting up in a cluster around the university, all involved in new technologies and services that will be connected with 5G, and it's a terrific opportunity for the UK to take a lead in that.
However, the UK hasn't got the best record for being able to deliver new mobile tech to the masses, as telecoms analyst Rob Bamforth explains.
There were issues with 3G in terms of the speed of rollout and deployment, in particular device availability. What's been different with 4G is that devices have started to appear, but what's lagged in the UK has been investment in the infrastructure to move it up to the fourth generation of cellular technology.
So no need to trade in your old phone just yet. Past experience tells us that a new mobile standard comes along every 10 years or so, which means that we can expect 5G mobiles to appear on the shelves around 2020. Robin Powell for DW at the University of Surrey in Guildford.
Well, as we heard there in Robin's report, Britain is only just rolling out its 4G network connectivity, a process which has been described as having been painfully slow by some. The UK's 4G rollout has been in part overshadowed by the threat of a legal battle between the dominant telcos. Everything Everywhere, which is a merged firm comprising of Orange and T-Mobile and goes by the name of EE, have had the go-ahead to start offering 4G services, and they're doing that in major cities first. Rural areas will have to wait, as is often the case, as will Vodafone and O2, which will have to wait until next spring for the UK's regulator, Ofcom, to auction more of the frequency spectrum that's needed to make 4G work. It's created an unfair situation for those who don't have the required spectrum. That's the companies, I mean. Well, Stuart Newstead heads the independent telecoms consultancy Elair, and he also chaired the Mobile Experience Group for the London Olympics 2012. And given the competitive advantage offered EE, I asked Stuart Newstead first whether now was the right time for the UK's 4G rollout.
Well, for Everything Everywhere, definitely they have the spectrum available, which is always the scarce resource when you move on to a new technology. And so for them, it's exactly the right thing to do. The UK has had a number of delays in getting the right spectrum available, still has not had the auction for the other operators to get hold of what they want to do. That won't happen until next year, so from Everything Everywhere perspective, definitely the right thing to do. 4G is rolling out in other countries, so there's some learnings they can take from there, both from the other Orange and T-Mobile companies, and also from the vendors that they're using.
But should perhaps, from the UK regulators, Ofcom's perspective, should perhaps, in terms of sort of fair competition, should they not have waited, even though Everything Everywhere had the spectrum and the others didn't? The others had to say that they wouldn't take legal action over this.
It's been a very, very complicated and very, very long game that people have been playing for a number of years, partly to do with what we call the digital dividend, so the release of the spectrum from the TV switchover, which has only just recently been completed in the UK, partly from legal action by Vodafone and O2 not to give up previous spectrum they had. So I think there's been a very, very complicated set of negotiations, and this is at least a temporary way forward. There's going to be no perfect solution simply because there's too many vested interests. But this at least gives the UK a start in the market. Otherwise, we were starting to look a little bit behind the game.
Now, you mentioned other countries. You're saying that the UK would look as though it was behind the game. How does the UK compare to other European countries?
Most of the European countries, at the very least, have had the auction, and a number of them are up and running, at the very least, again, at the very least with trials, and most of them with some kind of service. I do think one has to be careful. We've learned the lessons from 3G and before that from 2.5G. that rushing into the market for the sake of it is not the right thing to do. So just saying one is first in a market isn't necessarily significant. What matters is having the right, having three things in place: having the right devices, having the right network in place, and having the right applications on it. And it tends to take some time for that all to fall into place. So as an example, Everything Everywhere, so EE, they're using the brand name EE for the 4G service. They have a limited number of handsets and a limited number of cities. They're only operating in a limited number of cities initially, and so it's not yet going to be completely barnstorming offer.
But even if we leave the idea of being first to one side, 4G has been seen as a way to get broadband internet to slightly more remote areas, to rural areas in a number of countries. Yeah. And as you just pointed out there, 4G is starting in the cities, isn't it? The rural areas are again having to wait, and they're going to be the last to benefit from this, aren't they?
There's a number of public funds that are available. So there's been trials in, for example, in the southwest of England, in Cornwall, the very southwest of England, which has used 4G as part of that rural rollout. When it's just literally left to the market, so no regulatory support, no public subsidy, the rural customer is always the last in line, be it for fixed broadband or be it for mobile broadband. With public support then, or some kind of public-private partnership, then the rural parts of the country or rural parts of any country can be more swiftly brought into line. And a wireless solution is often the most cost-effective one, so a 4G instead of a fibre solution, for example.
Given this experience, and there has been sort of some a hangover from past experiences where some providers are said to have been a bit cautious because of their experiences with 3G, the 3G rollout. Yeah. If we're looking forward to 5G now, and the UK is starting up this innovation centre at the University of Surrey, is it really the country to be doing this, or do we have to see research as one completely separate thing from implementation?
I believe that the research and implementation are two different things. The research that is going to happen at the University of Surrey is primarily to keep the UK at the table when it comes to defining global standards. So it's the UK seeking to gain benefit from a global rollout of particular standards. And so if you like, a royalty coming possibly to the UK. That is separate from what happens within a particular country about the auctions and about the implementation of that particular standard there. So to my mind, they're two different things. In about 10 years' time, we might be seeing a 5G rollout within the UK, but say at any time in about, say, 3 or 4 years' time, we will start to see the 5G standards defined and therefore royalties starting to go to whoever was crucial to that the definition of the standard.
Stuart Newstead, telecommunications consultant and chief executive officer at Elair in the UK. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, always follow us at DW_SciTech.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Three-dimensional printing has been around for a while. You will have heard about it on the show a number of times as well. But until recently, you'd only ever have found a 3D printer in a well-funded university or in a corporate office, for instance. Now, if you've never seen one in action, imagine an inkjet printer laying ink on a page line by line. A 3D printer does the same thing, except with plastic, ceramics, metal, and sometimes even cookie dough, laid in layers, one on top of the other. Daniela Czeslow has been along to a 3D printer workshop in Dusseldorf and met a few tech heads who have even used 3D printers to print the parts to build their own little machine.
Amateur 3D printing has become an open sourcer's dream. There are programmers working on free software to send digital files to the printers, and there are engineers developing free instructions for how to build printers at home, even using parts that can themselves be printed. In Dusseldorf, German designer Axel Gantz hosts a 3D printing workshop. Gantz says 3D printing will change the world. He fell in love with the technology when he first saw it in action 3 years ago at a fair for geographic software.
I was very impressed because I've never seen a machine before which is able to build real physical objects out of digital files.
What can you build with a 3D printer?
Architectural objects, models, or you can print parts for model kits, or when you got a Walkman and the motor doesn't work anymore and you have to change a wheel in it, then you can print out a new wheel and fix it.
We're standing in a room with seven pairs of like-minded enthusiasts. They're each trying to work the 3D printers they built from scratch. Small strings of bright green plastic litter the desks. There are MacBooks everywhere. And a few instructors explain how the software works.
You basically program an object. The machines you have built were designed entirely in this.
The printers look homemade. Picture a wheel of bright plastic wire hanging over a black wooden frame. That thin wire feeds into a printing head below that moves from left to right over a red square base that moves from front to back.
This setup allows the printer to get a thin line of plastic in all three dimensions.
See all the red pieces here? All of these, they're printed. So all the plastic parts have been printed on another printer, just like this one.
That's Clement Yaniv, one of the instructors at the workshop. He says 3D printers can cost as little as 250 euros, as a group of builders in Spain discovered by recycling parts from old scanners. But a 3D printer kit will usually cost you more, about 850 euros online.
What happens is first you start with a model, a 3D model of a cup. The machine will then draw the first layer, the bottommost layer, which is attached to the build surface. It makes a drawing in plastic of the bottom layer of the object. And then it moves up a bit, and then it prints the second layer on top of the first layer. And then you repeat that again and again for all the layers until you get to the top of the object. And that's it.
The workshop is filled with young students and engineers and older businessmen and hobby builders. Bruno Kriener and his son drove 400 kilometers to Dusseldorf from Bad Kissingen.
We want to use the parts for a multicopter. That's like a helicopter with 4, 6, or 8 rotors.
Gantz wants to make frames for his glasses.
And then I will go to my optometrist, and I hope he can put the glasses into it.
Not all the printing went without a hitch. One team of engineers was printing a bright green Statue of Liberty when their machine suddenly stopped working. The statue went home headless.
We seem to have a defective power supply, so we're going to switch that off.
Gantz says 3D printers will make it possible to beam products across the internet, Star Trek style.
Maybe someone will scan this very nice cup and you can send it to the printer and copy your nice cup 10,000 times. The whole discussion about rights in the digital world and rights on the internet will get a new dimension with 3D printing when you can copy design objects lots of times.
Already, 3D printing has a huge following. Besides parts and instructions, you can also find printing files for free or a small cost online. Printers have been used to make high-tech running shoes, to make jewelry, and even a working flute.
I'm quite sure that 3D printing will change our lives. I think in about 10 years, everyone will have a 3D printer at home.
Daniela Czeslo, Deutsche Welle, in Düsseldorf.
With the season for harvesting wine grapes, just on another issue I should point out, with the wine season for harvesting wine grapes just about over in the Northern Hemisphere, Europe's winemakers will be busy making new stocks, and some may even be wondering whether they should stick with the humble cork stopper or move with the so-called times. For years now, wine drinkers have watched as real corks in bottles seem to be disappearing into extinction, and the cork stopper was being supplanted, it seemed, by newer artificial alternatives. But scientists in Spain are helping to bring about a renaissance of cork, which they say just can't be beaten. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
A noisy Spanish bar isn't the kind of place you'd expect to contemplate the finer details in life, such as how wine is corked. But in Docamar, a bar in Madrid, you'd be surprised at the strong opinions of drinkers when it comes to whether they have their wine poured from a bottle that has a traditional cork or an artificial one.
Do you prefer to drink wine from a bottle with a real traditional cork or a plastic cork?
I prefer the traditional cork.
Why?
Because I suppose it's a better wine.
I prefer the traditional cork.
Do you think it tastes better?
Yes, but sometimes you have to be careful because if the wine is touching the cork, sometimes you can have a bad taste.
So the old-fashioned cork has its supporters, but they're not just in the bars, they're also in the labs. The Catalan Cork Institute has been carrying out scientific research on how to improve the performance of traditional corks. It receives some private funding and the backing of the regional government of Catalonia, a cork-producing region in the northeast of Spain. The managing director of the institute, Manel Pretel, points out traditional cork's most obvious merit compared to the plastic stopper or the screw cap. Because it's 90% air, it can change shape according to the bottle it is in and ensure a perfect fit. Pretel says this also leads to another advantage. A traditional cork lets wine breathe just the right amount.
With other type of closures, namely synthetics and screw caps, they are either too airtight, I'm talking about screw caps, and therefore they don't let the wine breathe and it develops some off flavors. And on the other hand, with the synthetics, what you have is too much air. In a few months, you will have some oxidation of that wine.
Perhaps the greatest challenge for Pretel and his team has been to hunt down the infamous chemical known as TCA, which is often blamed for giving wine an unpleasant, musty aroma. The researchers subjected cork to a variety of different conditions and combinations of those conditions, such as pressure or steam, and they found that in order to prevent TCA and other damaging molecules from flourishing, cork must be handled in just the right way between the moment it is stripped from the tree until it is ready for the bottle.
Since it has a biological or microbiological origin, it's very important to control the moisture and also to avoid the contamination that can appear along the process.
Pretel says the TCA chemical has now virtually been eliminated from Spain's corks. But even he concedes that convincing those in the business to avoid artificial stoppers has been tricky. Wine stores like La Tintorería in Madrid are feeling the economic crisis, just like most industries in Spain. Consumption is down, particularly of more expensive wines, and wine producers are trying to cut costs, as Begoña Arce Olivares, who works in the store, explains.
Artificial corks are much cheaper than traditional corks, so there are wine sellers who use artificial corks in their cheaper wines to bring down the cost and put them on the market at a lower price.
The drop in wine consumption and preference among many sellers for plastic stoppers has hurt Spain's cork industry. But over the last year or so, Spanish cork has been making something of a comeback, selling better than any time since 2007, before the crisis hit, and confirming the country's status as the world's second biggest cork provider, after Portugal. The Spanish cork industry's entry into new markets has helped this revival, but so too have the scientists who are working to improve cork quality and the toughening up of EU standards for the sector. These stiffer controls place greater emphasis on the end product, using chemical analysis and an expert panel of human testers to check whether TCA or other contaminating molecules are in the cork. Manel Pretel still thinks that more effort should be spent on communicating the message that cork is unbeatable, not just when it comes to ensuring the quality of wine, but also in safeguarding the environment.
It's not just the quality, it's the environment, and it's also a culture and I think a sustainable sector. We've done our homework, but now we have to transmit all this progress.
But in the meantime, it still seems as if there's plenty to celebrate for those who believe in the old-fashioned cork stopper. Guy Hedgecoe, DW, Madrid.
Now, staying with culinary things, did you know that each year Germans throw away enough food to feed 15 million people? A German filmmaker called Valentin Thurn has been raising awareness about the problem with a documentary about food waste, but he's also heading a project to develop a mobile phone app called Food Sharing. Rather than throw away good food, the app can help people give away what they don't need for free. Here's Kathleen Schuster.
Do you see the screen of the iPhone or any other smartphone, and on top of it is the logo Food Sharing, and then you have a map.
Valentin Thurn is explaining his latest idea to me. It's an app called Food Sharing. This is the idea. Don't throw away food that's still good. Give it away to a neighbor instead. customers will always buy too much, says Tuan. But he and his project partners think that if people give away food from their fridge a few times, then they'll start to think about food differently.
If you go with your mouse or your finger on the dots, that shows you, okay, there is 10 kilo of potatoes.
The 49-year-old German filmmaker received international attention over the past year for his documentary Taste the Waste, which helped raise awareness about massive food waste in the West. Now, he has found a way to take his anti-food waste movement one step further by helping people to share food.
Every single item we don't throw away helps a little bit to reduce the demand on the world market. If the prices on the world grain markets are rising, poor people in Africa and Asia can buy less bread, for instance. This is the indirect consequence of our wasting to hunger.
Studies estimate that German households are responsible for more than half of all national food waste. Each person in Germany throws away an estimated 1.2 tons of food every year. That's enough to feed 15 million people. In response, the German government launched a series of anti-food waste initiatives in March. It's using a website and flyers to inform Germans about how to waste less food. But Thurn envisions a more interactive approach.
The moment you participate in such a scheme as food sharing, this is also a mental change. I assume you buy differently and you buy maybe less, and then you start also thinking about what am I buying. And the moment you start reflecting where does my food come from, you probably will buy differently.
It's hard to say whether Tuan's idea of a food sharing app will work at all because he hasn't tested it yet. Plus, people could do this on their own without a smartphone, yet they don't. Up the road in Münster, several college students get ready to go dumpster diving. Dumpster divers take home whatever they find from supermarket trash bins that's still edible. Not because they can't afford to buy it, but because they want to make a point.
One night we rode back and forth four times and probably brought home about 30 kilos of good quality food and another 10 kilos of potatoes. So yeah, that makes a big impression on a person.
Moritz, who doesn't want his last name mentioned for legal reasons, began a year and a half ago after reading about how supermarkets throw away food they could still sell. Since dumpster diving is illegal in Germany, there aren't official statistics on how many people actually participate in this growing international protest movement. Moritz thinks Thurn's idea of a food waste app is one of many necessary steps toward curbing food waste.
It's not a simple problem either, where you can make a blanket statement like, down with the evil companies. Just like you can't say, go dumpster diving. You have to find different ways to solve this problem, every person for himself, and then together too. But there's certainly not a single solution that will fix everything.
Thurn says there's a will in Germany to make a change. In fact, three cities have already expressed interest in testing out the food sharing app in coming months.
Kathleen Schuster reporting there from Cologne. And that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. You can listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfikar Barney. Our studio techs were Thomas Schmidt and Senja Denchik. Coming soon, the future of games. So keep an eye out for that. Hope you can make it then. Thanks for listening and bye for now. We'll be right back.